Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloen. Sometimes the most interesting stories wind up being right under your nose, or in this case, across the street. Just a few hundred yards from our studio is a tiny research laboratory housed in the Physical Sciences Building at California State University, Chico. Thanks to the generous donation of Nobel laureate William Phillips and the National Institute of Standards and Technology, the physics department has been able to pioneer a program in undergraduate research into quantum physics using lasers to supercool atoms. Professors Haywan and Joe Pechkas are both former collaborators under Phillips at the University of Maryland. Literally the coolest place on campus, the lab is where undergraduate students are able to probe the quantum nature of atoms, doing research previously only accessible to graduate students at larger universities like Stanford and MIT. Joe Pechkas and one of the students engaged in the research, Michael Doris, who's a first-generation college student studying physics and electrical engineering, joined us in Studio C to talk about this program. Later on, Pechkas also tells us about a unique class he teaches for mostly non-majors called the Physics of Music. Joe Pechkas and Michael Doris, welcome to Blue Dot. And we are talking about undergraduate research, which is something that's kind of relatively new to me, at least. I always think of research as being done by graduate students when they're getting ready to get their master's degree or a PhD. Could you guys just start by telling us what is the purpose and the value that you see with doing undergraduate research?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think traditionally was the case. Typically, your R1 major research universities and your national labs typically be the place that are doing the research. But what we see is, at undergraduate level, that this doing research, real research on open-ended problems, is really important for students learning and developing skills that they would use in real-life applications and real research, and also take those skills to other areas. So my wife, Haywan, is assistant professor in physics here at CSU Chico, and we're building this project together, performing this research with these students, which is, I think, very key in the sense that between both of our various expertise to be able to do this here, to this kind of research with the facilities that we have. So our goal is, I think we've had about last summer, 8 students in the Physics Summer Research Institute that we mentored. So mentoring these students in the lab and also mentoring them outside of the lab in their coursework push the project forward and push their careers forward is very key. This type of research is very collaborative, very team-oriented. You really can't do it without a large support network of students and faculty to do it, especially at this undergraduate level.
And just from your point of view, Michael, what do you think?
I agree with a lot of that, especially for students, though. For us, many of us just go to school and think going to do the book work and showing up for lecture is sufficient. But doing undergraduate research really opens doors for you. It makes you realize that you can do more than just homework and tests. So it gives you a lot of skills and a lot of confidence as well.
Well, let's talk about your actual research. It's in investigating what you call cold atoms. So I'd like to start out. Let's really back up and do a primer on what exactly is it about getting atoms very cold that makes them more important for study as a physicist. Joe, could you just give us a little 101 on cold atom physics?
Really, we want to talk about what do we mean by cold, I think, to begin with, and what do we mean cold atoms. When we think it's cold outside, we might think at 32 degrees Fahrenheit that, yeah, this is really cold. But, you know, in terms of the scale of the universe, it's really not cold at all. That's pretty hot. So you might think of some place like outer space being the coldest spot you could be. And that's at about minus 454 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's really, really cold. And when we're dealing with these ultra cold atoms, we want to actually get them a lot colder than that, because for us, that's really not so cold. All right. So usually we think about, instead of talking about the Fahrenheit scale that we're typically used to, we'll talk about absolute temperature scale called the Kelvin scale. So minus 454 degrees Fahrenheit is about 3 Kelvin, right? And this absolute scale is defined such that 0 Kelvin means 0 temperature. And really what that's saying is you can't get colder than that. Everything is frozen in space. And so what we're trying to do is cool these atoms down to close to that 0 Kelvin. Actually, in fact, we're at about a millionth to a billionth of a degree Kelvin, so much, much colder than outer space itself.
Wow. Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
My understanding about 0 Kelvin, and it's also that it's not 0 degrees Kelvin, it's 0 Kelvin, is that is the temperature at which there is no motion at all for an atom. Because what temperature actually is a measurement of the average kinetic motion, that the energy, the motion, as it were, the kinetic energy of anything, of moving particles. So when we, you know, take a thermometer out and we measure the temperature outside, what we're really measuring is how much are all of these air molecules jiggling around. And the more they're jiggling around, the higher the temperature is. So is it true that 0 Kelvin, there would be like no motion of an atom at all?
Exactly. Yep. They're really frozen in space. So to give a scale, at room temperature, which is 300 Kelvin, the molecules are moving around about 300 meters per second. That's 3 football fields per second, which is really fast. So when we get down to these ultra cold temperatures, micro Kelvin, nano Kelvin regime, we're really talking about speeds of a few feet per second or centimeters per second. So this is very, very cold. So cooling is really slowing.
And why is it that studying atoms under those conditions is so interesting for you as a physicist and important?
So there's a couple of interesting things. One, just having them slow, they're there for a long time, so you can make very precise measurements. But there's also some interesting things that go on aside from that, one of which is they start to become, instead of billiard ball-like, as we think of classical physics, more wave-like. They start to spread out in space as you get colder and colder. So you start to study their true quantum nature, their wave nature of matter. And they don't act like billiard balls anymore. They act like waves, which can interfere with each other. And then we can study fundamental quantum physics.
And is that why lasers are so important for these kinds of experiments? Because they can help you probe the wave nature of these particles?
That's correct. Lasers themselves are an example of quantum physics that we see every day. Actually, one of the very few macroscopic, meaning large scale, systems where you can actually see quantum physics. And what we do with lasers is we use the lasers actually to cool the atoms. It's the first thing we do to get them cold. You can think of your atom like a giant bowling ball rolling down the lane, and you fire a little ping pong ball. That's like your little particle of laser light, right? And you can imagine that there's a little collision between it and that bowling ball gets slowed down ever so slightly. Right, but now I have a laser, so I have billions and billions of ping pong balls. So I just can continue to do this, and this is how I can cool the atoms down, and uh-huh. I can get them down to, again, you know, a few feet per second.
Well, let's talk about what's going on at California State University, Chico, and I happen to be an alum from Chico State, so very proud to be talking to you today. But I have to say that, you know, when I think about, you know, research and physics, I think of places like Stanford and UC Berkeley or MIT or Princeton, not Chico State. So tell us about how this became part of the curriculum, part of the physics department there, because I understand it involves a Nobel physics laureate who's also a mentor of yours, William Phillips. Could you tell us about the backstory about how this came to be?
Sure. Yep. So several years ago, before I and my wife, who's also working on this research project, had arrived, the department had really made a significant effort to implement more research into the curriculum because of the importance of it for undergraduate education. And so we came here in about 2016, hired to set up a cold atom lab. And what was really instrumental in this is that our advisor, Bill Phillips at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, his group was very generous in donating a significant portion of this equipment, which without that, we wouldn't be able to start up this type of research.
So, and right about the same time is when, Michael, isn't that about when you became a physics major there at Chico State, 2016?
Yeah, that's correct. Originally, I was just electrical engineering, and then I got exposed to some physics classes, and I saw how passionate the faculty was there. They were really eager to make sure I was okay and that I was learning everything, and it kind of encouraged this curiosity I've always had, and they kind of converted me over to a physics major. And one day, I was talking to another professor, and I was like, hey, is there any possibility that you guys could help me do research or an internship or anything like that? And she was totally like, yeah, I know someone. I can hook you up with Dr. Petchkus. And then I guess the rest is history. That summer, I was awarded some funds to do research and start building the cold atom lab. And we built the lasers that are currently being used on it.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot right now, Michael, because this is not easy, I don't think. But, you know, this is radio, and we can't show people a picture, although they'll be able to look on our website and see it. But could you describe what the apparatus is that you work with, what that looks like, and what it entails? Like, what kind of equipment are we talking about here?
What it looks like? Well, if you can picture it in your mind, you've got a gigantic circular chamber of steel. It's got a lot of pipes and windows on it. You've got lasers and optics all over the place, and you have six beams firing into this chamber. You have gigantic coils of wire wrapped around the chamber to establish a magnetic field. You have vacuum pumps and gigantic power
basically
supplies.
Basically, these are tabletop experiments, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. This is done on an 8x4 foot table where this is all housed.
And what are, tell us about, what kind of work you do. There must be just lots of intricate work to get all of this stuff aligned and calibrated. Tell us a bit about, a little bit of the actual engineering aspect of working with something like this.
Well, at NIST, they actually have running apparatuses over there. So they were doing quantum simulations and quantum computing. NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They're the ones who tell you what a kilogram weighs and what Planck's constant is. They're the ones who...
They're the folks who tell you that 1 inch is 2.54 centimeters.
Yes. Whereas at Chico State, we're still building the apparatus. So that's much more hands-on, and there's a lot more engineering that goes into that.
Yeah, I would say that typical national lab or a major R1 university, one of the things that differs in about doing this research is the level of funding and facilities that they have available and support services. So typically there, the level of funding and support is such that you can get a lot of commercial products, commercial lasers, and commercial systems that are used for this. Where you're going into the smaller universities and to the more teaching universities, the smaller state schools, a lot of this has to be hand-built. So for example, Michael's first project was to build the lasers for the apparatus. And so that's what he had done, building that. And what we're working on now, Michael and other students, are retrofitting the vacuum chamber that we received from NIST. This is current coil design, et cetera. And so there's a lot more of do-it-yourself electronics and building and machining, whereas you have other support services at a larger institution that you don't have here. And there's pros and cons to both of those.
And so maybe tell us a bit about one of the things that might be a story about a frustration you had working with this equipment where you hit a roadblock and a difficulty that you had to overcome.
There's quite a few of those. Honestly, the biggest issue early on was getting the apparatus to fluoresce a cell of rubidium. So basically make it light up. We have to get these lasers to be very accurate color-wise. And unless you're very on point with the wavelength, the rubidium cell won't do anything. And the rubidium are the atoms that we're cooling. And I can recall spending days aligning optics and messing with current values and temperature values just to get this laser to work such that I could get a little cell to fluoresce.
Yeah, so essentially it's not simply you take some laser light and shine it in and you get cold atoms. These lasers have to be tuned to a precise frequency. And so we have a reference that you have to lock that frequency to just tune it just in just right. And doing that, anything doing for the first time when you're building something, there's always challenges. So I think there are new challenges at each step, but those are also, you know, what students are learning from.
Yeah, those are the real, you know, that's what you really learn from is coming up against those problems and frustrations. If everything was easy, you wouldn't learn anything.
It wouldn't be worth doing.
And can you tell us about what kind of precision you're talking about with a frequency? I'm intrigued now. What kind of precision do you need at a wavelength to actually get this to work?
At the wavelengths that we're dealing with, these lasers are in the near infrared, so they're 780 nanometers. You can see from the visible covers, 400 to 630 nanometers or so, 50 nanometers. So they're just out of our range of our spectrum here. And what turns a frequency that means is you're talking terahertz frequencies, so very, very high frequencies. And our laser, so that's about 10 to the 15 cycles per second. And our lasers has to be tuned within a megahertz. So that's 10 to the 6. So you're talking to be a very, very precise a fraction of the actual frequency of the laser light that this needs to sit and stay still at.
So, wow, that's like you need to be within a billionth of the frequency. Is that about right?
About right. Yep,
yeah, that's
correct.
That's a pretty good idea.
Yeah, that's amazing. And to think about all that happening in a teaching university, that's really, to me, astounding that you get to do that. And are there any other state universities doing anything like this, Joe, that you know of?
In the California State University system, we're the first to develop a cold atom lab. And again, that's in part because of the generous equipment donation that we have. There are other smaller institutions that do this type of research, but generally it's mainly the R1 major universities and national labs that have the capabilities to do this.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with CSU Chico Physics Professor Joe Petchkus and his student Michael Doris. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's get back now to our interview with Joe Petchkus and Michael Doris as we talk about cold atom research for undergraduates at California State University, Chico. I'd also like to ask you to explain to our listeners and me, what are some of the practical applications, if there are any, or some of the real research questions you're answering? So why is doing this at the end, once you've built this and you've done this research, what are some of the things that you hope to learn? And what are some of perhaps the technical applications down the road that might come from this kind of research?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the best application that's been developed is the atomic clock. Cold atoms, laser-cooled cold atoms, make the best clocks, and this is necessary to have GPS. At GPS, you have satellites positioned above the Earth. They're moving very fast, and you have to actually take into account general and special relativity in order to look at the very small time differences because of this between the different clocks that are orbiting around. And atomic clocks make this possible for GPS to work. So that's probably the best example of why you'd want to study this, of an application that's available to us now. But I think one of the main thrusts now of this research is to look at something called quantum computing, quantum information, where we study these cold atom systems and see if we can develop new types of computers that run on not just the laws of classical physics, but now run on the laws of quantum physics, where things behave like waves, where you don't have ones and zeros, but you have some combination of ones and zeros. And you can, in principle, be able to do certain computational processes much faster than you could with all of your supercomputers in the world. And so this is one of the main focuses of this research.
Wow, that's, and you know, when you mentioned the atomic clocks, the first thing that popped into my head was Einstein's special and general theory of relativity, because it was really the advent of those clocks that allowed us to start to say, oh yeah, we can confirm that when these clocks are set in motion compared to clocks, say, on the ground, a clock put on the International Space Station, for example, will run slower, right, than a clock that is back on Earth.
Right, exactly. The precision of these is tremendous. I think they're very soon will be able to get to a precision where they'll lose about 1 second within the age of the universe. So that's 1 second within 13.7 billion years.
Yeah, NIST's most recent atomic clocks are actually so good now that they're saying we need to come up with a better theory for gravity because they're too accurate and everything else is kind of falling behind.
Wow. And as a student, you know, as an undergraduate student, do you ever, I would imagine you do, think about those big picture things about, you know, the work of Albert Einstein and trying to combine these two great theories of physics? Do you ever think about the implications of the big picture when you're working on something like your apparatus there?
All the time, yeah. It's literally, like he said, you know, you're standing on the shoulders of giants, basically, and a lot of this stuff, I'm sure, will make a huge difference one day, especially as students. Many of us probably don't realize that not a lot of students get to do this, and it does change your life for the better and opens a lot of doors. So hopefully I can help toward that end someday.
When was it for you, Michael, that you first really got interested in the sciences and math? Was it something that you liked in high school, or was this something that came later?
It was kind of something I've always had. My father encouraged this curiosity in me to know more and to always try to learn more and to read as much as possible. Although my original dream as a kid was to be an astronaut, but I guess that's the same for a lot of people. That didn't pan out because, you know, wearing glasses and not being in the military and stuff like that kind of deters you from becoming an astronaut. But honestly, it was really other people believing in me when I started going to Butte College and then Chico State. That kind of really pushed me to actually believe in myself and think that I could make a difference in the world and actually achieve something in the sciences.
Yeah, and I'd like to add to that in the sense of our role in getting students like Michael to come in is partly showing them what they're capable of and what's possible. I think many students come in not really knowing how far they can go, not knowing what they're capable of. So that's part of our goal is to get that get them, of course, the experience, but also that confidence. And, you know, there's a world outside that they can get to that next step. And so I think one of the major goals with as educators in our department is to try to get the students to the next level, get them to the next step up, get them to good graduate schools, and get them to achieve beyond what they thought they could achieve before.
Yeah, a lot of the students doing this stuff are actually first-generation students. So a lot of us aren't used to thinking that we can do this sort of thing. And Chico State has been really great about encouraging and making first-generation students believe that they can achieve, like, graduate school and other cool internships and engineering things.
Joe, is there advice you could give to anybody out there in education, say from any grade level, but it's something that you've learned about how to inspire your students to reach beyond what they think is possible?
Yeah, I think what you need to do is really show the options that are available for students, be active in encouraging them, and try never, of course, to discourage, and really, I think meeting with students individually, finding out what they're interested in and trying to recognize what are the strong qualities that a student has, and then, you know, show that to them that you know, hey, you look like you're somebody who's interested in experimental physics. You like building circuits and playing around with math. And, you know, maybe you should try this. I think that encouragement constantly and just to kind of open up their view of the outside world, because I think many students, without seeing that outside bigger picture, they just don't know what they're capable of yet. And I think showing them that is really important.
And have you seen an evolution at the university and other universities of using this type of undergraduate research to facilitate that?
Yes, definitely. The American Physical Society, which is the premier society of physicists in the United States and in the world, has even put out a list of best practices. And undergraduate research is one of the top practices for undergraduate education, for benefiting them for their careers, whether it's going off to graduate school or into industry or business, what have you. So I think in the past several years, there's been a much greater push to incorporate those educational experiences, those non-traditional educational experiences at the undergraduate level because of its value. You're getting something that you just can't get from a textbook or your traditional classroom setting.
And yet I would think you have to have some underlying tools that you have learned in a traditional way in order to be able to do that kind of work.
Definitely. And that's one of the challenges, particularly in various types of research. Do the students have the proper skills to do it? And designing a research project that suits them. Our particular cold atom experiments are quite nice because there's a variety of research and textbook physics that they can start out with, from basic electromagnetism all the way to undergraduate quantum physics that they can start applying. And so, depending on the student and their level, we kind of tailor that experience for them. But that's one of the challenges. Give them a project they're going to learn from and be successful at, and they can do real research.
And so for you, Michael, what's kind of the next steps? Where does this all lead for you, do you think?
Graduating would be the big thing, hopefully. After that, going to graduate school to get a PhD in physics, again, hopefully.
I get the impression talking to you that you will graduate.
I hope so.
You certainly will.
Hope so.
And do any schools appeal to you for your graduate work?
A lot of them are on the West Coast. After going to NIST, I'm looking at Maryland now because that seems to be a very popular school for physics. And the people over there were really kind, although I need to adjust to the culture of the East Coast. It's much different than the West.
Yeah, sometimes that's the best thing to do, though, is to experience another culture like that and broaden your horizons. And one of my friends grew up in Hawaii, and she wound up going to MIT to study physics. And, you know, that was really a broadening experience for her.
I'm sure an amazing experience as well to go to MIT.
Well, we're going to wrap it up here in a moment. But anything else, Joe, you'd like to add about the program there?
I'd like to say that since... we've come here, and since the department itself has started really full on with undergraduate research, basically a few years ago, what we started was this Physics Summer Research Institute, just about a year or two before myself and my wife had arrived. And when that started, there was only one student in the program. And this is summer research opportunities for undergraduate students. This is basically when we get the bulk of our research done. And the following year, I think we had about five. And the year after that, there were about 12 students throughout the whole department. Mm-hmm. I think last summer, it probably went up to about 15 or 20 or so students. And these are opportunities that were provided in part by generous donations from alumni for funding to give them stipends for students to do this work. And I think that's been really instrumental for improving the research environment, providing these different opportunities that students just wouldn't otherwise have. I think we have so many applicants now, we're starting to turn students away because we just don't have the room to fit everyone. So this, I think, has been really instrumental in helping our students get the best educational experiences possible.
Yeah, just to add on to that, a lot of the professors, too, are actually volunteering their time to help us. They don't get paid for it over the summer, which I think is amazing and should be mentioned. And it really does open up a lot of doors for us. I know I kind of already alluded to this, but those summer research positions tell us as students that we can actually accomplish something. They give us hope that we can do something. And that's a really amazing experience for us. And I can't thank Chico State enough for giving us that opportunity.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, the conversation resumes with physics professor Joe Pechkus and student Michael Doris. They're part of a unique undergraduate research program at CSU Chico. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Thanks for listening. Let's return now to our interview with Joe Pechkus and Michael Doris from California State University, Chico, as we talk about quantum physics. One of the things I wanted to know about once I got to know Joe Pechkus was a bit about his unique class called the Physics of Music. Let's hear that conversation next.
Like most physicists, I'm interested in music. I wouldn't call myself a musician. I try to play piano, it's something that I interested in, and trying to combine my two interests seems like a good idea for me, making a really good, interesting course that's unique. And the course that we've developed here at CSU Chico is one that's based off a course developed actually at the University of Connecticut by Professor George Gibson. He started this course with the intent of introducing those students who would not be interested in physics as a way to get them interested in it. Basically, if you can think of all of your art and music majors, as we say, most physicists like music, but not many musicians probably like physics. How can we get them interested in physics? And most of these classes, they teach really how an instrument works. And we're really primarily interested in actually using music to teach physics. So it's a bit, that idea is a bit flipped around from other physics and music courses.
Can you give us an example of like what is a direct application of this? So give me an example of one of your lessons where you would be teaching me something about music where physics is applied.
Really, physics of music is the physics of waves. And quantum physics is also wave physics. So what we're trying to do is to, by teaching waves in music, how can we teach about waves in, say, quantum mechanics? So, for example, one of the demonstrations I do is interference of two speakers, which if you're in music and recording, you care about maybe interference effects that you have, right? So you take two speakers and you separate them, and then you find out that they interfere in space. You hear some points as you walk around the room where it gets louder and some parts where it gets softer because waves interfere. Well, we can do the same thing, for example, with a laser beam. Take two laser beams and split it in two, and you see places where they interfere, where it's bright and dark. Or you could take, for example, in quantum physics, again, with cold atoms, take a cloud of cold atoms, separate them in two, and then allow them to interfere. And you see light and dark spots, these interference fringes. And so it's all the same wave physics. They're completely different systems, but the mathematics and the general principles are the same.
And I imagine when you start out with the fundamentals of it, you're talking about pretty simple ideas, like, for example, pitches, what we think of as notes, are just different frequencies. They're just different vibrations. They're the number of vibrations per second, which we call in physics hertz. Like a tuning fork has a number on it, like 256, and I forget exactly what note that is. I think it's C. But that just says that when you pluck a guitar string and you are getting a C, what is happening is that guitar is vibrating. The string is vibrating 256 times per second, right?
Exactly. And what's interesting about that, the plucking the guitar string example is you don't only hear the pitch. Pitch is really what frequency is, right? Higher pitch, higher frequency. But the interesting thing is that string can vibrate not just at one frequency, not just at your example, 256 hertz, but twice that frequency and three times that frequency. So actually, quantized frequencies are allowed. And so when you pluck a guitar string, if you were to pluck one that was tuned to 256 hertz, you would hear all of those frequencies, those quantized frequencies. That gives that rich, colorful tone, the timbre of the instrument that tells you it's a guitar and not a tuning fork. And this happens in quantum physics. Hydrogen atom has its own musical scale built in, essentially, with different frequencies, different pitches of light, if you'd like to say.
Have you ever had the experience of perhaps working with or teaching or talking to a musician where they had an insight, where they felt a deepening of their understanding that also, you know, deepened their appreciation for their art?
Yes, definitely. I think that when I speak to the music students or the recording arts students that we have here or the faculty, they're so interested in this that when they hear about there's so much more going on under the surface about why certain instruments work, why do the scales work the way they do, there's a mathematical reasoning behind it. I think they have a deeper appreciation and understanding of their music, and I hope through this course to give them a deeper appreciation of physics as well.
One of the things I always find interesting is that some people think, wrongly, I believe, that when you break something like something beautiful like music down into its physics, that somehow you're making it less interesting or less beautiful. Whereas I look at it the other way. When you have an understanding of the physical principles of what's really going on to produce this beautiful music that you're hearing, whether it be a Beethoven sonata or perhaps a piece by Rush with Geddy Lee playing the bass guitar, that you have a deeper appreciation and a more profound experience of beauty.
Yeah, I think that's definitely correct in my point of view. I think once you've learned about that, what the underlying principles, just like learning how Beethoven wrote a particular sonata or the form that he used, the musical theory behind it, you appreciate that music more because it's so interesting. You know, why does that piece of music sound different and unique and pleasing? And similarly, when we learn about the intricacies of the instruments and the scales themselves and the mathematical relationships, to me, that's more profound, and it just enhances that beauty. Similar to when we learn more precisely about the underlying physical principles of the universe, it makes it just that much more interesting.
Yeah, and I don't think it's necessarily that when you're listening to music or looking at a beautiful sunset that you are consciously always thinking about the physics behind it. It's just that it's kind of there, and it just deepens your appreciation.
Yes, I definitely agree with you on that.
Well, what are some of the what's some of the fun activities that you do in that class?
So what I'd like to try to do is to try to make this class as hands-on and interactive as possible. So what we try to do, teach it in a somewhat studio physics style where we're doing experiments as we learn in the classroom. So there's no separate laboratory. But for example, what we may do is we may do this example of the two speakers that I gave you before, where we look at how they interfere with each other, and we do this with laser beams as well. We may also look at, say, the different vibrating modes of a vibrating string that we had talked about. So trying to get them really to hands-on, start to turn some knobs with some real equipment and make actual real measurements to kind of reinforce that, oh, I really get this concept now that there's more than one frequency that's vibrating at one time when I pluck the guitar string by, say, doing a FFT of the signal, looking at the actual spectrum.
And what's an FFT?
Excellent. FFT is a fast Fourier transform. Basically, all that's doing is Imagine in this kind of setup, I've got a guitar or piano, or it could be your own voice, and I've got a microphone and a computer, and I just can take an audio sample of that, measure that signal on my computer, and that'll tell me all of the different frequency components that exist or are allowed in that string. So for example, on a vibrating string, like we said before, I'll pluck a C note at 256 hertz, and this gives me the ability to actually see all of those frequencies ringing at one time.
And in your class, have you ever seen like a moment where a student just like all of a sudden got something, especially if they're a musician, where it was just like that aha moment?
Yeah, definitely. I think particularly with the hands-on interaction of working with equipment, that certainly these concepts, again, this is for a non-science major. So, you know, it's very conceptual. We're not doing rigorous math. We're not doing calculus at all. So I'm trying to do very conceptual hands-on experiments. And definitely as they start to turn knobs and they get to see this going on, that really gets it to click more with them, that they can see, aha, I got that. I understand that that's what was going on. You know, I could say the words up in front of class, but you know, they might not get it. They might truly get it. They may think they do, but when you actually see it and do it, it's a different experience.
What's one of the hardest concepts to get across in a class like that? What's like one of the most complex things? It's like, this is a challenge, but you know, you've been able to figure it out.
So I think that the toughest concepts are trying to relate the waves of music, right? How the wave physics corresponds, that once we've learned that, to other types of wave phenomena in nature. And I think trying to bridge that gap, that you know, sound is a wave and therefore interferes, light's a wave and therefore interferes, matter particles are waves and they interfere, and trying to see how that there's a connection between a broad spectrum of phenomena within the universe. I think that's the most difficult part to get across.
And is this a semester class that you teach?
That's correct. It's one semester class offered every semester.
And it's basically for your non-physics major type students. But it sounds like the physics majors might like to take it too.
Yes, I hope that there'd be something for everyone in there. Again, it's geared for non-physics majors, those people who I think would be adverse to physics, but hopefully for the physics majors might find that this is kind of a fun class, maybe a way they can see this material in a different way than they've seen it before.
So for a student out there that's scared of taking a class, that's any kind of class that has the word physics in it, what would be your advice to them?
My advice would be, you know, do it. Don't be scared to take it. When I teach this class, I go through in quite a bit of depth of working conceptually through each of the topics. You know, I looking mainly for concepts, not mathematical rigor. So I'm going to go through and teach you each of the definitions. We're going to kind of walk through it step by step. And, you know, you're doing something that's challenging, but playing music is challenging. Anybody who's played piano has learned that it's very difficult. You need to do a lot of practice, but you can learn it, right? And same with physics. It's about building small blocks at a time to where you're getting from, instead of just playing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, to maybe some Beethoven piece or what have you, for Elise, for example.
And I like that concept of, because it really is true with physics, mathematics, anything like that. It really is just like learning a musical instrument. It's a matter of the amount of practice that you put in is when you get to that feeling of accomplishment and mastery.
Exactly. I think that just like a music student would practice every day in order to get better, you know, small increments at a time, that's how you learn physics too. You do a little bit each day, and you eventually build on the skills that you have for greater complexity. And I think it's just like any musician is not necessarily gifted, but they put in a lot of hours of work, just like a physicist. But you don't need to put in 8 hours a day as a professional musician or a professional physicist to enjoy physics. You can learn some of that skill, just like I can learn tennis, for example, put in some time to get better at it. I'm not going to be a professional tennis player either, or professional athlete, but I can still enjoy it and get greater appreciation from it.
Well, Michael Doris, you're a physics major. Why would you want to take this class?
Honestly, it has to do with that whole profound thing. Talking to a lot of physics majors who do play music, I personally play piano and trumpet, it makes you realize that there's something underneath everything. Although there's this complexity to the universe, it's all the same once you get down to the very bare bones of it, and that's kind of beautiful. So it's a nice opportunity to expose yourself to something where you're familiar with the topic, but it's being applied in a different way, and it just further reinforces that whole idea that there is something underneath everything that is shared in common.
Before we go, one last chance, Michael, is there a question you'd like to ask your professor about music and physics?
How much homework is there going to be?
That's a good one.
That is a good one. It's not a lot of homework.
Okay.
It's a little practice. I'm going to give you practice just like you're going to start learning Twinkle Twinkle with both hands. Okay.
I can do Twinkle Twinkle.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining us, and good luck with both your research and your course, the Physics of Music. I'm going to encourage students that I run into to take that class.
Great. Thank you.
After our interview, Joe Petrikas agreed to return to the studio to do some demonstrations of sound that he shares with his students in the Physics of Music class. He joined our producer, Sky Schofield, in Studio C for the demonstration. Let's listen.
What I had in mind here was to kind of demonstrate what's going on when you're listening to an instrument. We all know that if we hear a violin or a guitar or a piano or a drum, they sound distinct from each other, right? So why is that? And the idea is we talk about pitch in music, right? And we're talking about pitch when we say that in music. What we're talking about in physics is the frequency. So we might hear an A note on the piano or an A note on the guitar or whatever instrument we're playing. And for example, A440, that's your concert A that your pianos are tuned to. And so you might hear that. That's A440, right? Now, what that means is 440 hertz or 440 cycles per second. That's basically that metal bar of the tuning fork is vibrating back and forth 440 times per second. So if you were to look at it, you'd see a blur because your brain can't process visuals that quickly. But your ears can process it as a pitch. So the higher the pitch, the higher the frequency. If I were to go up the scale, I would hear higher notes. If I go an octave above for an A, it'd be 880 hertz, for example, 880 vibrations per second. If I go a lower A, it's 220 vibrations or oscillations per second. So, you know, one question comes, well, why does A440 on piano or guitar sound different or any instrument? And you can get into things, well, why does a drum sound like a drum? But just sticking with kind of your melodic instruments, right? Because we know there's a difference when we hear that. And certainly good conductors can hear, you know, which are the flutes, which are the oboes, et cetera. So what it has to do is with what's called harmonics, that you just don't have a single frequency going on there. Because if we did, if it was only that 440 hertz that I heard on my A, then all of my instruments would sound like tuning forks, which would be pretty boring. And so that's a guitar, and that's 440 hertz. But I'm also hearing these other additional frequencies on top. And it turns out they happen to be not just any frequency vibrating, but integer multiples of those. And same with the piano. So that those additional frequencies that you hear, it's essentially like you've got a whole musical scale underneath that's being played every time you strike a string. And that gives it a tonal color, or music we call it timbre. Uh-huh. And so that's what we'll look for. That's what makes each violin even sound different. And when players play, each player will sound different, how they strike the string, how they bow it, for example, give it a different tonal color. That's subtle, but it's definitely noticeable.
Are those all in... Like for the guitar, are those harmonics all coming from the chord, or is it the actual body of the instrument as well?
And first you look at it, and you can look at just a vibrating string, and you can see these harmonics. But certainly the musicians know that the wood, the thickness of the string, all adds to different subtle tonal characteristics, different timbre. You still know it's a guitar, but there's a difference between a guitar that's $5,000 and one that's $500. And it's because of those characters. How do those tonal qualities resonate, become louder in ways that you find pleasing to your ear? So those are all important on how that transfers to the listener.
And you brought some examples. Can you show me some of the...
Yeah, sure. So let me give you an example here, right? We already heard the tuning fork. And there, tuning forks are designed to only have that one single frequency. So all you hear there is just one single frequency, 440 oscillations per second, right? So we'll play a couple of sound samples here just so you can hear what happens here. How can we see how important these other frequencies are? Here's what I've done here is to record some instruments. And then what I've done is I've taken out all the other higher harmonics or higher frequencies that are being played. And I just add in a single frequency each time for my recording. So I've taken a simple sound. I'm going to just first play the pitch, which is the fundamental, that first frequency alone. So it'll be all 440 hertz, and you can hear how it sounds. And with each time that's played, I'll add in one more harmonic or higher frequency.
So you said those are multiples, so that would be 880.
Exactly. They're integer multiples. So on a string instrument, you'll hear 440 hertz, 880 hertz, et cetera, et cetera. 3 times 440, 4 times 440. You don't hear every frequency, only certain ones. And there's some interesting physics and mathematics behind it. But let me just show you what I'm talking about here. So here's one example. And as you listen to it, see if you can think of what instrument it is. See if you can pick it out. So I've just added in one note, and then I'll add in the next. So hopefully by the end, that last one there, that had all of those harmonics, all of those additional frequencies. Again, it's essentially like you've got a whole musical scale built into the note when you play it. And so hopefully you heard at the end that sounded like a guitar, and it was. Mm. It was actually this guitar that I have here. And that's that note. And some people might have heard, and they might thought, well, that kind of sounds like a harpsichord, perhaps, and that's also a stringed instrument that's plucked, so a keyboard instrument with strings that are plucked. So, again, depending on what you might think, there's an underlying interesting psychology of what we're anticipating or not. So we can also take a listen to some others here. I'll just do another instrument here, and again, listen to it. I'll play it. I'm going to filter out all the other higher frequencies. Just leave that fundamental, that first tone that gives you the pitch. It's going to be 440 hertz. And notice the first one all the time, each time, sounds kind of like a tuning fork because it's just one wave that you're hearing. And then I'll add in additional frequencies or waves each time. So that's one added harmonic. And we'll add a second harmonic on top. So you may, at that point, after only 3 harmonics, might guess what that instrument is. And so that's a piano. And in early electronic music, one of the first things to do was electronic synthesis of music, synthesizers, where that's what they're really doing, is trying to recreate by just adding in those frequencies in addition to it to give it that tonal color. Nowadays, I think they do a lot of actually sampling of real instruments because it's tough to get all the intricate details of how you strike the string, and how that note decays. And so that's all comes into play.
Thanks again to our guests, California State University Chico Physics Professor Joe Petchkus and CSUC Physics and Electrical Engineering student Michael Doris. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. You can listen to this and past episodes at mynspr.org or subscribe to our NPR podcast via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by PRX. Hey, that's the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by Mr. Blue Sky Schofield. Our associate producer is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.